This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you're looking for the federal government to fix the American healthcare system, Jeff Bauer says you are looking in the wrong place. Bauer is a health futurist and medical economist, a thought leader in an industry that many say is broken. Bauer spoke last night at Illinois State University for the kickoff celebration for the Mennonite College of Nursing's 100th anniversary. Bauer tells GLT's Ryan Denham, the country isn't spending too much on health care. It's just spending it in all the wrong places.
Well, the American healthcare system right now is a mess. It is not following any coherent plan. Indeed, when I, in my speeches and writings, describe where we are headed in healthcare, I lay out so many different paths that could be followed or are being pursued by different people that it tends to confuse audiences. And so my summary statement is really that if you think you perceive some clear direction, you don't know what's going on. On the other hand, if I've laid out a fairly confusing and uncertain vision of the future of healthcare, I've been very clear in explaining what's going on. I like to tell people that I'm a full-time health futurist, have been for about 30 years, and I'm proud out of my track record. I think I've got the best batting average of anybody that's been doing it for that time. And I still have to spend an incredible amount of time and effort just to stay confused. Mm-hmm. There really is no vision, no leadership, no consistent path.
Well, it's been 3,000 days, more than 8 years since the Affordable Care Act was signed into law. Historically, I understand you've not been a big fan of that particular health care law. But what cumulative effect do you think it has had on the American health care system?
It's very hard to describe any particular changes that have come from the Affordable Care Act, in my opinion. I support the goals. I lived in Illinois. I was fairly close to some of the people that were in Washington, new faces in the Obama administration at the time, and trying very hard to convince them to take a reasoned approach. But I don't think it was so much the fault of the Obama administration, but more Nancy Pelosi's strong desire to get something done for Ted Kennedy before he died. I remember when they passed the law, she said we had to pass it to see what was in it. And that's because nobody knew all of the various components had just been thrown in to get enough Democratic votes with no Republican votes in favor of it. So it was really to boil it all down to answer your question, it was a very poor law from the beginning. And I think that it, rather than finding out a way to provide better health care to the American people, simply found ways to get more insurance to buy the existing system. So I liked at the time to characterize it as the same mess for less was sort of the goal. But it didn't really address the underlying problems with the inefficiencies and ineffectiveness of the American healthcare system. And so as much as I mean, my personal belief is that people ought to have health care. It ought to be a right. But I think we sure could have done a lot better than that law. And the political desire at the time to do something, even if the something was bad, was just never leading us in the right direction. And it's really hard to show any progress that has been made in the 8,000 days or whatever. 3,000 days, I guess it was. This is not the cynicism of a right-wing Republican. My own politics happen to be rather liberal. But a desire that I wish that we had done it right rather than simply change the way to get more people access to a system that's broken from the core.
In the past, you've proposed shifting reforms focus from expanding access to eliminating waste. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you mean by waste?
Well, I'm glad you focused on that because that really is at the base my view. The waste is all of the money that we spend on healthcare that cannot in any way be attributed to the patients being healthier. And I like to pose as my number one example there the fact that we in the United States spend twice as much money almost as people in any of the comparable countries, Germany, France, England, Canada, Holland, Denmark, just go down the list of countries like us. We spend pretty close to 17%+ of our GDP on it. They all spend around 10% or less, and yet all of those countries have healthier people. So obviously, by spending more money money on health care. We are not healthier. And as a medical economist, I'd like to think that more spending would make you better off, and it doesn't. So the waste is really all of that, those additional resources, the 5 to 7% more of gross domestic product that we spend and get a less healthy population for it. To be very clear in answering your question, since it might seem like there's a paradox there, I'm very strongly in favor of keeping 17% of GDP. I'm surprised that more people don't focus on that. I think we have the ingenuity. We could use the resources, the pharmacists, the nurses, the physical therapists, and all the other people that are really underutilized in our healthcare delivery system right now. If we could simply change the way that we produce healthcare services, what I like to call and will be including in my speech here at Illinois State, reinventing the healthcare delivery system. But the key is to go after that 5 to 6, 7% of GDP that we spend and don't get any healthcare for, and reallocate that. So unlike a lot of people in health reform, and I'd say this is the real flaw with the Republican view, they'd like to get the same mess for less, to revisit that metaphor, and spend 12% of GDP. And sadly, that would be a viable option. I'm a firm believer. Let's reallocate by reinventing and find ways to give everybody a healthier life. And so I'm in favor of improving the efficiency and effectiveness of healthcare, and have devoted darn near 50-year career to it now, so that we can reallocate resources to making people healthy. I'm not advocating that we become more efficient, more effective, so we can spend less on healthcare. And so I want to be real clear. Spending the same amount on healthcare is my goal, but spending it wisely is what we ought to be pursuing.
And you've argued that government-driven reform is not the source of American exceptionalism, as you put it, that healthcare reform's best bet is in the private sector. So what are examples of private healthcare organizations that you think sort of embody this approach?
Well, the really neat things that have been done have all been done on a regional level by people that, quite frankly, were openly thumbing their nose at the federal laws. Let me begin with the Kaiser Permanente system, which back in the 1970s was considered to be just a breath of fresh air, had much better results in terms of the health of the population, and intelligently used the non-physician practitioners. And so the president at the time, Richard Nixon, who was really the first health reform-focused president, decided to push Congress to pass a Health Maintenance Organization Act. And so that established federal criteria to get federal funds to be in a health maintenance organization. Kaiser Permanente, that was the model for the whole legislation, took one look at it and said, nothing doing. We don't need those kinds of federal restraints. We need to do what works for our population, no one size fits all. And beginning with Kaiser, I can just go down the successes. The Geisinger Clinic, the Mayo, to even go back prior to Kaiser. Intermountain Health, Group Health, Intermountain Health out of Salt Lake City, Group Health of Puget Sound out of Seattle. These are really exceptional healthcare systems that have worked out the kinks and really focused on making their populations healthier. And they've all done it without participation in the government programs. The people that continue to be spending lots and lots of money without showing better health tend to have been the people that went with the government programs. So, again, I'm in favor of healthcare, but I think local initiatives, privately led, and by private, I don't mean for profit. We have great private nonprofit organizations where no stockholder is benefiting. Geisinger would be a wonderful Geisinger in Danville, Pennsylvania would be a wonderful case in point, like Kaiser Permanente. So please understand, by private, I don't mean for profit necessarily, but at least not government.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Jeffrey Bauer, a health futurist and medical economist who's speaking this week at a kickoff event celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Mennonite College of Nursing at Illinois State University. Our conversation up to this point, Jeff, has been a little bit doom and gloom. I wonder if there are any trends in American healthcare that you think are encouraging, something that we might see as sort of a positive step.
I think that, and here's the gloom side, roughly 1 in 4 people in the healthcare business today, in other words, hospitals, health systems, drug companies, equipment manufacturers, doctor's offices, you name it, if you're part of the 17% of GDP going to healthcare, 1 in 4, roughly 25%, are going to be out of business 5 years from now. In other words, the getting a dollar and surviving all the regulations is going to be very gloomy, to the point of failure, reorganization of one sort or another for about 1/4. I think that somewhere around 40% are going to fumble through. They won't fail, but they're not going to set the world on fire. But if you do your math, that's still leaves 35%. And I think that, across the country, we're going to see pockets of really exciting things happening. I do have the pleasure of speaking all over the country in my business, and I find areas where really neat things are going on, but they tend to be small, locally focused efforts where people are in multi-stakeholder partnerships, meaning local health plans, healthcare provider organizations, a couple of large employers are collectively doing something that meets local needs. And so I think slightly more are going to thrive by reinventing healthcare than are going to fail by trying to hold on to the 21st century. So my view is it's all of the above. If any of my comments led people to believe it's all gloom and doom, there's plenty of gloom and doom in my forecast, but an even greater portion of really exciting things happening.
So our governor in Illinois has just signed a law giving Medicaid patients access to telehealth, behavioral, and mental health care. What do you see as the future in telehealth, essentially people getting care from providers who are not like physically in the room with them?
Telehealth is phenomenal, and I have seen it do remarkable things, especially now that a patient remote from a caregiver can take a picture with a cell phone that's diagnostic quality and have it lead to a change in a drug regimen or a little bit of coaching on how to change your gait after having your knee repaired. It's all really exciting. I've seen it firsthand. Every clinician I know that's had experience with it just lauds it. The problem is that the insurance system isn't paying for it, and people that get too hung up on being paid for their telehealth services are sadly more likely to end up in the group of 25% that's going to fail. But the people that'll work with local partnerships and say, how can we make sure that we don't lose money in the process of doing telehealth, telemedicine, are going to thrive. And I don't know anybody that's delved into it and rejected it. When properly managed, it's a key to the future. Patients love it. It leads to lots of efficiencies in healthcare. I could go down a long list of its benefits, but it's woefully underutilized, and that's generally due to the reimbursement problem, not to any problems with telehealth per se.
Do you think advances in genetic testing will impact the future of American healthcare in any significant way? I mean, it used to be really uncommon, right? It had to be ordered by a doctor. Now you can do at-home tests for genetic mutations that sharply increase risk of breast cancer, for example. Where do you think genetic testing is going in healthcare?
Well, I want to distinguish between genetic testing, this idea of sending a little vial of your saliva off to see your predispositions based on the genetic structure within your body. I want to differentiate that from genetic study of particular disease states. I am not much of a supporter of this idea of giving everybody a genetic test to look at their predispositions. There's a wealth of clinical literature, darn near the totality of it, that suggests genetics explains less than 20% of all our diseases. The vast majority, in other words, 80%+ of all the things that go wrong with us come from our health behaviors and the lack of sleep and drinking and driving and ending up in a wreck or not exercising. And you can have total genetic understanding of your ancestors and still be a health wreck. The real benefit, and therefore I want to be clear, I think there's a remarkable application for genetics, but it's looking at the genetics of our disease conditions. So once you've got the coronary plaque that could lead to a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, or the cancer can be typified at a molecular level to show what the genes are expressing, that's the real key. And there it's remarkable. So testing everybody, I'm not very excited about that and don't expect it to go very far. On the other hand, using genetics to better study the diseases we've got and target in on the most efficient and effective cures, sky's the limit. That's very exciting.
How do you think that access to more and more patient data will change how healthcare providers and health insurance companies treat their patients? I mean, what are some of the upsides and downsides to that glut of patient data that is only going to grow in the years ahead?
I'm a health data geek. That's how I got in healthcare in the first place. I think it's phenomenal. I think that analytics, using databases to understand the interactions between drugs and patients with certain molecular types of disease, that's the wave of the future. That's how we're going to quit wasting money. It's by understanding that level of detail that allows us to target in on exactly the right drug to get this particular cancer, or not give a drug for a liver condition where we know by our data analysis that no drug has ever worked. So analytics is truly an absolutely essential foundation. The thing I rail against, and so a lot of people have heard me talk about data, say, well, Bauer's against data. I'm against all the bad data we've got out there. If there's a common denominator of my years as a professor and writer of lots and lots of textbooks and articles about healthcare data analytics, probably the biggest single component of all that I've done in years of publishing so as not to perish as a professor, et cetera, it would be that we need to have better data. So I'm 100% believer in more analysis, but we have to make sure that our numbers are not flawed in the first place. And sadly, I'm not alone. Editors of some major journals would agree. The majority of our data, some people have gone as high as 80%, don't accurately measure what we think they do. And if we don't have accurate measurement, then we're going to come up with bad conclusions. So if we work on the accuracy of the data, it's the wave of the future.
You're speaking at a nursing college. Those folks who are training to be that next generation of providers, what do you think the future of healthcare workforce training will look like? And what are some trends that schools like Illinois State University should keep in mind there moving forward?
Medical education's gotten pretty darn good. I've spent 20 years as a professor at two medical schools, so I'd like to think I speak somewhat knowledgeably of that. What I think is underutilized is our non-physician clinicians who have skills and defined scopes of practice which are every bit as good as the physicians. So I'm doing a 25th anniversary edition of a book I first wrote back in 1993 called Not What the Doctor Ordered. And that's really my plea that we recognize the skills of especially nurses. That's why it's so exciting to be here as the keynote speaker at the 100th birthday celebration of the Mennonite College of Nursing here at ISU. Is because nurses have skills that could contribute so much more than they do contribute because of problems with the payment system, problems with state practice acts that require them to practice under the general or direct supervision of a physician, when there's every single research study that's ever been done show that the nurses acting independently within their scopes of practice and with the right training do at least as well, if not better, than the physicians. So I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. I should have said a quick answer to your question. I think that the real key to future of healthcare, doctors are really getting quite good. The key is to liberate the advanced practice nurses, the clinical pharmacists, the doctorally trained physical therapists, the doctorally trained psychologists rather than psychiatrists, the people that can complement the roles of physicians, but to give them the independence to do it. And if we would simply get serious about that and put more resources into the qualified non-physician practitioners, who as a rule of thumb cost about half what a physician costs, we could do remarkable things. So I'm excited to be here speaking in honor of 100 years of a great nursing school, because so much of the future is nursing. We just have to march to our legislators and get them to change the state practice acts so that we allow them to do what they're already perfectly well trained. And as I say, I'm updating the book. I've already got over 300 references from refereed peer-reviewed journals that show how well these qualified non-physician practitioners do. There isn't a single, not one published article that I can find anywhere, nor many, many other researchers that look, that shows any deficiencies in their practice, and yet most states still don't give consumers access to this.
That's Jeffrey Bauer, a health futurist and medical economist, who's speaking this week at a kickoff event celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Mennonite College of Nursing at Illinois State University. I'm Ryan Denham.
Last night's event begins a year-long celebration of the Mennonite College of Nursing centennial. The college became part of ISU in 1999 after previously being a private college. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.